Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Dr. Mads Gilbert. Mads is in Norway. He is a Norwegian anesthesiologist and a university professor at the North Norway University, professor of anesthesiology. I had an uncle who was an anesthesiologist long, long time ago. He began as a family physician, and he was our family doctor. A marvelous, marvelous man way back in the 1940s and 50s when in America doctors used to make house calls in the middle of the night. Try getting one to come out now in the middle of the day, never mind the middle of the night. But Mads and Dr. Eric Fossey both performed heroic services in Gaza during Israel's onslaught, what it called Operation Cast Lead. We've certainly talked about it many times on this program. And they wrote a book titled Eyes in Gaza on their experiences there. They were there during the war. They saw firsthand what was going on. They saw the carnage against individuals. They saw it. You can't imagine it unless you see it. And I'll mention one thing. I had a couple of programs with guests in Gaza. In fact, two of them were doctors. One I couldn't get the first time because he was scheduled to come on, but he couldn't because the shells were falling and exploding. And I had two of them on at the same time. I got one, and on the same day I couldn't get the second one, because shells were exploding, and he had to leave his home to get to some place he thought was safe. It was quite an experience for me, literally, to be talking to someone in Gaza in the middle of a war who apparently felt it was safe enough to come on with me, while the shells may not have been falling that close to him, but they certainly were falling. That was maybe my most dramatic moment on the air, just to understand what was happening in the background while we were doing an interview on what was happening. Let me mention one more thing by way of introduction. Then I want to read you a paragraph from Mads' book as an introduction to letting him take over and explain just what he saw and what he did. But I write about Israel-Palestine all the time. It's a core topic for me. I've written more about on that topic than any other single one by far, and I have a new article going out tomorrow, and I call it Daily Israeli Crimes Against Humanity. There is simply no doubt. The evidence is there overwhelmingly in black and white that every single day, not a single day goes by, that Israel does not commit one or more crimes against humanity. And a simple way to follow it is to do so on the website of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Every week, they publish an account of what happened during the previous weeks, 7-day period, and it is a litany of atrocities of one form or another. Whether it's bombings, whether it's killings, whether it's home invasions, whether it's arrests, whatever it may be, they include it in their weekly account. And once in a while, I'll go to it, and I'll mention some of the highlights from one of the week's reports. But my article this time, really ever does the U.S. media, or do the U.S. media, cover what goes on there? Virtually never on television, the way it sometimes appears in print. It did recently, several times in January, in the New York Times. It was on a horrific killing of a 65-year-old man. Israeli soldiers, I think quite a lot of them, maybe dozens literally, burst into his home before sunrise, and they murdered him while he slept in bed. And then afterwards they claimed that they made a mistake. They made a mistake. Even if they were after a serial killer, you don't burst into somebody's home and murder them. That's not giving them due process. Even Israel claims it lives by the rule of law, but of course it never does. Certainly not against Palestinians. Well, the New York Times, this was so horrific that the New York Times had to write about it. The only problem with what they wrote in three articles is what they didn't say, not what they did say. And that's always the problem. What is not said, much more than what is said. And I included in my article an account of a young Palestinian woman in her mid-30s. In fact, her name was Jawahar Abu Rama. She was murdered by deadly gas. It's deadly when it's used in concentrated form that Israel does all too often. It's called CS gas. They use it to disperse crowds. But this woman was off at a distance, and the cloud of it apparently got close enough to her that she inhaled it, and that was the end. She died in the hospital. Then Israel tried to fabricate reasons that she wasn't there and she died of something else and so on. Well, the Times didn't cover that story. They covered the 65-year-old man. But let me get into Maad's book, because I certainly want to have him spend the majority of the time talking about what he did. Here's one paragraph in his book, and this gives you an idea of what was on his mind. And I'll just quote him exactly. "They bombed the central vegetable market in Gaza City 2 hours ago. 80 injured, 20 killed. All came here to Shifa, the hospital. Hades. We are waiting in death, blood, amputees, more children, a pregnant woman. I have never experienced anything so terrible. Now we hear tanks. Pass this on, send it on, shout it out, anything. Do something, do more. We are living in the history books now, all of us." Mads, I welcome you. That was a very long introduction. Once in a while, I have a habit of getting carried away at the beginning, but I welcome you so warmly. It's a great honor for me to have you on.
Thank you for having me, hello to all of you on the other side of the world from northern Norway in the middle of the winter darkness. We have eternal darkness. We don't see the sun now until another week has passed. The sun will come back, and hopefully also more peace and prosperity for the people of the world, I hope.
Oh, absolutely. I can't think of anything more important than that. But let me just ask first off, what made you go to Gaza in the first place?
Well, you see, in Norway, there has been a long-standing solidarity movement with the Palestinian people. We've had a very strong national solidarity committee called the Palestine Committee, and in particular, medical people have been having a long tradition of providing medical support to the Palestinians, be it in the refugee camps of Lebanon, on the West Bank, occupied West Bank, or in Gaza. And I am one among many hundred Norwegian medical professionals, doctors, nurses, paramedics, and so on, who have been working with the Palestinian healthcare system over the last 25, 30 years. So for the last 10 years, I've been traveling in and out of Gaza and doing education, clinical work, and training of medical personnel. So in 2008, before the attack started, I had been to Gaza three times already, and I just came back in November 2008 from a teaching mission at the Al-Azhar University, where I'm teaching as a visiting professor in emergency medicine. So when the attack started on the 27th of December 2008, it was my instantaneous reflex to start to put together an emergency surgical team to travel to Shifa Hospital. And we were actually also urged and asked by the Palestinian Minister of Health, Dr. Bassim Naim, to go. And together with my good colleague and long-standing friend, the surgeon Erik Fosse, we met in Oslo. We got a very solid support from the Norwegian government. We got a financial grant for the mission. And we traveled to Cairo with a plane. And we got full logistical and political and diplomatic support from the Norwegian embassy in Cairo. And on New Year's Eve in the morning, we managed to enter Gaza through the checkpoint in Rafah on the Egyptian side. We went straight up to Gaza City, which, by the way, happens to be the twin city of the city I'm living in, Tromsø, in northern Norway. And we reported to the Minister of Health, and we said, we are here. Where do you want us to work? And he said, we have been waiting for you. We know that the Norwegians always come in times of war and crisis. And here are your greens. Get dressed and start to work in the operating room in Shifa Hospital.
I have a Palestinian friend who lives in America, Mads, whose sister is a doctor and in Gaza. And she probably worked at Shifa. I'm not sure. I wanted to have her on the program, but my friend said she does not speak English very well. So she was reluctant to come on, so I never got a chance to have her on, which is a shame because, like what you're doing now, you can describe firsthand what you saw and what you did. And unless you went through that, you can't do it by reading a report. But you were there, and you performed heroic medical services. Talk about more about what you saw and what you did.
Well, both Dr. Erik Fosse and myself, we have been working under difficult conditions, both in occupied Palestine, in Beirut, and in other war zones of the world. I was in Beirut in 1982 during the Israeli invasion, siege, and bloody attack on West Beirut. And this was my first graphic experience of the horrors of war, modern warfare. We worked in a makeshift hospital, Lahut, off Hamra Street, and those months in June and July of 1982 has always been for me thought to be the most horrific experience of my life. Unfortunately, I have to say that Gaza 2009 surpassed Beirut 1982.
Huh.
We came to a hospital that had been receiving hundreds of casualties over the previous 3-4 days, and from an initial phase of total chaos, the hospital now appeared structured, organized. And since both Erik and I have been working for many years with doctors, nurses, and other health staff people in Gaza, we met many of our colleagues and friends. So we came to a hospital that we know quite well, and they know us. And, of course, this was a huge, huge advantage. The wards were absolutely overflowed with injured and the relatives, the families. The hospital itself was exhausted from the many years of siege. The hospital lacked everything, spare parts, drugs, medical equipment, electricity, water. The bombing of Gaza City had been very close to Shifa Hospital. Indeed, on the second day, they bombed the mosque of the hospital, which caused all the window panes in the surgical building to explode and to be shattered, and it actually killed one hospital worker and injured four. So the hospital was very cold because it was without window panes, and this was in January, and the Mediterranean is close, it's only 4 blocks away, the coastline. So it was freezing cold, and as a doctor, I know that hypothermia will add bad to worse. If you are injured and you bleed, you will bleed more if you're cold, let alone the discomfort of being injured or scared and having pain, and it's very cold around you.
Matt, when you say freezing cold, I remind listeners that this was going on in January.
Yeah.
And even in Gaza, it can get very, very cold.
at nighttime, we were between 5 and 10 centigrades, and combined that with the strong Mediterranean winds, we had a wind chill, I think, down to just a couple of centigrades around the freezing point certain nights. So it was very cold, and bear in mind that the families, the poor people of Gaza, and the majority of the population in Gaza is indeed below the UN poverty line because of the siege and the blockade from Israelis. So many of these families did not have any means of heating their homes prior to the bombing. For one reason is that Israel has control with the electricity supplies to Gaza, and they cut it off when they attacked. The second reason, of course, being that the supply of gasoline and any source of fuel or burning material is lacking in Gaza. So they were cold when they were hit and injured, and became even colder during the transport to the hospital. So that was one impression. And Shifa is, you know, it's a modern 600-bed, could have been a university standard hospital. It has a very good staff of more than 500 doctors and 600 nurses. It's extremely experienced in the art of managing war casualties because of the many years of onslaught from Israelis. And even given this extensive experience, of course, they faced an extremely difficult situation because the current of injured, dying, and dead was endless. And it came into the hospital minutes after we heard the bombing. We would hear the sirens of the ambulances and the horns of the cars. You know, they were blowing their horns all the time. And they came running in with their children in their arms, in private cars, in taxis, and in ambulances. And it would fill up in the emergency room of Shifa Hospital. We could have waves of up to 100 injured, and 50%. Every second injured was a child or a woman. So the overall majority, between 85 and 90% of the injured and killed, were Palestinian civilians. When these waves of injured came into the hospital, it was quite well organized. The Palestinians are world-class experts on improvisation and crisis management. They have been taught in the hard school of being under siege and occupation for so many years. So the work would flow. We would try to prioritize the patients, find out who could be saved and who could not be saved. The walking wounded, those who could walk and talk, were dismissed immediately out in the darkness again. We could not house them in the hospital. Those who had too extensive injuries, who we would normally in my hospital today, I work in the University Hospital in Tromsø, if we have one traffic injured who is about to die, we would do all we can to save that one person. But if you have 25 persons with severe injuries, you have to find out who are those 5 or 6 or 7 that you can save, and then let the others die. This is an extremely dramatic shift in the way we perform medical work in a peacetime and in a wartime situation.
It is really shocking, Mads, and of course you're doing it not only in a war zone, but under the most dire conditions when you simply don't have enough of everything you need because Israel refuses to let it in, and they bomb the power station, and they cut off the electricity, as you say, and they don't let fuel in, and they literally create the harshest possible conditions. Israel has a name for what they do in terms of targeting civilians. They've really done it going back decades. Civilians have been always as fair game as anybody who might be a resistance fighter. Israel calls them terrorists or militants. I call them what they are. They're resistance fighters wanting freedom, just like everybody else wants freedom. And under international law, they have a right to fight for their freedom, especially when they're being attacked. But Israel gave this a name in 2006 after the Lebanon War. 1982 really was horrific, as many as 18 or 19 or 20,000 killed, who knows. And then the refugee camp Sabra and Shatila where Ariel Sharon was defense minister at the time, and he unleashed the extremist phalangists in Lebanon to murder in cold blood 3,000 civilians in those refugee camps, and the Israeli army was there supervising, watching it all. They simply subcontracted the mass murder, besides the rest of the mass murder that they conducted. But in 2006, they waged war on Lebanon just the way they did on Gaza. Whether one was worse than the other, I don't know. But I wrote about both in great detail, an awful lot more on Cash Lead, Mads, because I was at this a lot longer than when I was writing in 2006. I wrote two or three times on the war on Lebanon, but what I wrote, I remember, was absolutely horrendous. This mass destruction, mass slaughter, a displacement of hundreds of thousands of people, and willfully targeting civilians, and the name Israel gave it was Dahiya. Dahiya is a Lebanese village. It was just massacred. It was attacked brutally, and Israel, I quoted Israeli generals, two or three of them, saying that civilians are as fair game as anybody they would consider a militant. A village where somebody fires one shot, everybody in that village, there could be 1,000 people, there could be 5,000 people, every one of them is a legitimate target if one person fires a pistol. That is Israel's philosophy, but it's really worse than that. The philosophy is literally to target everything that lives and breathes in what they consider enemy territory or an enemy, and it's mostly civilians, as you say. The vast majority of the people killed in Gaza during Cash Lead were civilians, and the numbers were something like over 1,400, plus the vast destruction, targeting civilian targets as well, Mads. Mosques, hospitals were hit, schools were hit, universities were hit, fishing boats were hit, farmers in their fields were hit, and
yeah.
Police.
Yes, of course, and I think we all subscribe to a condemnation of this massive attack on civilian infrastructure. And well, I come from a small nation, Norway. We were occupied by the Danes for 400 years. We've been occupied by the Swedes, and we've been occupied by the German army. And we fought them all, and we managed to uphold our national sovereignty. So I think one explanation for this strong solidarity with the Palestinian people from the Norwegian people is that we are also a small nation, 4.5 million people, and we know to cherish and to uphold our national sovereignty. Bear in mind that the Norwegian Solidarity Movement do not support, be it Hamas or Fatah or the Palestinian Authority. We support the Palestinian people as such, and the Palestinian people's right to resist occupation and oppression. And we also support their right to choose their leaders as they like, just as we want to choose our leaders of the United States or of Norway as we like. So these are fundamental principles. And when we go in there as medical staff, you might say that we do not uphold neutrality. But if you are silent in a historical situation of attack, oppression, and aggression, you become complicit. Neutrality is, in these situations, equal to complicity. And of course, on the individual level, if we had an injured Israeli soldier or an officer from the Israeli army, that patient would be treated just as good as any Palestinian patient. This is also our ethics. But we signed up with the Palestinian people and their right to resist. That's why we went to Gaza. That's why we worked in Shifa. And that's why we wrote the book Eyes in Gaza, in order not to tell our story, but to convey the narrative of the Palestinian people, of these 1,400 families who lost their loved ones, of these 5,400 injured, of whom we saw many, and of this Palestinian society that is still under...
Umaz, are we still connected? I think we were disconnected. Jason, if you could get Mads back on the phone for me.
Oh, sometimes this happens in a place a little less developed than Norway. Norway is certainly very well developed. I didn't realize Norway was that small. I know it's a small country. It's even small in territory, but it's a lot bigger in territory than 4 million people. Oh, that surprises me. Hopefully we'll get Mats right back on again. I don't know what happened. The Castlet story was absolutely appalling. Evan.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
What will be the impact of the Tea Party on the upcoming midterm elections? Who are these Tea Partiers? Are they really only a bunch of right-wing rednecks? Listen in every Thursday night from 7 until 8 Eastern to A More Perfect Union as your host, Bill Thompson, gets the inside stories from actual Tea Party players. Call in with your comments and questions, challenge guests, or show support. A More Perfect Union, Thursday nights, 7 until 8, only on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, and I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions. Or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back. We were indeed briefly disconnected with Mads, so we took an early mid-program break, and we're back now. Mads, I guess we're back. You're back on again.
Absolutely.
Oh, I guess that does happen once in a while, but no problem. We simply call back and get reconnected.
I can tell you that this happened all the time in Gaza when we were called by international press
probably the Israeli intelligence, Mossad, interrupted our lines. We were even invited to take part on the Larry King live show of CNN.
My goodness.
And Eric was actually connected to CNN. They called us on his mobile phone nothing less than 10 times just prior to the interview. And every time we were about to go on the air, the line was cut. And guess who cut it?
Oh, there's no question who cut it. Of course,
yeah.
That's on major U.S. television. So it was very obvious to the powers that be in Israel and over here, Mads, that that you would be on air. For you to be on this program, I think maybe they know about it, but we don't have the reach that a CNN program has. And I never followed Larry King. Usually he has nonsense stuff on. I'm really astonished that he would have a program featuring someone like you and Eric, because that is not what he does. His program is really an entertainment program, not an information program.
Yes, I know. Yes, I just wanted to mention this because when I get interrupted during an interview with some U.S. media, I just recall how often we were cut short. And as you know, that during the Operation Cast Lead, the Israeli tactic was to deny access of all the international press corps into Gaza. And that was why we, in fact, became the only quote-unquote white voices who could report from Gaza to the West world about what was going on. This black curtain that the Israeli government wanted to pull was really an offense to anybody, regardless of their view on the occupation of Palestine and Israeli policies. I think it is really an insult to all of us that that a strong government and a state like Israel is denying people access to information. That was, in fact, what happened. Be it BBC or CNN or Fox News or other Western media and newspapers, they could not get into Gaza simply. And this is one, if not the first time in modern history, that a ruling state is completely obstructing the flow of free information and free press. And I think it is quite stunning that the U.S. government did not raise its voice against this this attack on your absolutely fundamental value in the U.S. of freedom of speech.
Well, Mads, the U.S. government does exactly the same thing. They obstructed journalists getting into Iraq during the fighting, unless they were escorted by U.S. troops. The term used was embedded. So
yes,
in other
I know
words,
that. We know that. Yes. We follow this closely in Norway too. But I think despite that, they could not, the U.S. government could not deny a Norwegian journalist the possibility to be in Baghdad during the bombing, which they were. But there were absolutely not a single Norwegian, Swedish, American, German, or any other Western journalist in Gaza City. But we have to bear in mind that at any given time there are about 600 very good Palestinian and Arab journalists, but the tactic from Israel was to describe them as Hamas propaganda machines. So if any Arab with a pair on the screen, even if it was a qualified journalist, he would be dismissed as untrustworthy. And that's why our voices actually became so influential, because it was more difficult to discard us as propagandists, even if they tried that. We were, at the end of the day, two Norwegian doctors supported by the Norwegian people and by the Norwegian government on a medical mission, and we just told the world what we saw. We did not add on any political analysis or add on. We just told the numbers and the horror of the injuries and the magnitude of the attack on the civilian society in Gaza.
Matt, you were an independent person. As you say, you were a doctor, you weren't a journalist. You came as a volunteer. You really had the kind of credibility that Israel fears. But I must say, emphasize again, America and Israel are absolutely linked on anything of importance like this that goes on. And these things don't happen on the spur of the moment. These wars are planned many, many months in advance. And before Cast Lead began at the end of December 2008, there was a quiet period in Gaza. Hamas, which happens to be the legitimately elected government,
didn't seize power. The Palestinian people elected Hamas.
Yes. All this we know, and we've written about this extensively in the book, about the history, the backdrop for the attack, and we're happy that our book, Eyes in Gaza, came in its English edition in October last year, and it is available through Amazon.com. I was just in New York before Christmas, and I checked out 7-8 different bookstores, and I was a little bit surprised to find that it was not available in any of these big, well-reputed American bookstores. But the title of the book, Eyes in Gaza, can be ordered from Amazon.com. It is a very extensively documented encounter, the story of the attack on Gaza, about 300 pages. It's very heavily illustrated with our pictures. There are useful maps and statistics in the book. So I think as a source of knowledge and insight into the situation in Gaza, I think it is actually quite useful.
Well, Mads, I don't believe in introducing you. I don't believe I mentioned the title of your book. So no. Let me do it again. I have a copy of it in my hands. It has a very, very important picture of a young Palestinian child. Anybody looking at that child on the cover, on the soft cover over the book, you see an innocent child with his head bandaged. I think it's a young boy. Hit one of the many victims of this war. And again, the title is Eyes in Gaza. And you, Mads, and Eric Fossey co-authored the book. And many, many pictures in it. And again, you live this. And you saw firsthand what happened and the people affected. And some one thing that I wanted you to talk about was the effects of some of the terror weapons that Israel used. These are weapons that either are illegal or should be illegal, like the dime weapon. You saw the results of the dime weapon. Explain that.
Well, dime is an abbreviation of dense inert metal explosives. Dense inert metal explosives. It is a new type of explosives developed by the U.S. Air Force. I believe some arms industry research facilities in closely connected to Berkeley University in San Francisco has been central in the development of this weapon technology. It is actually an alloy of heavy metals. And this alloy of heavy metals, once ignited, it will go into a fission process, almost like a nuclear process, and it will explode, and the heavy metal will vaporize and go into a damp phase, a vapor phase, and create a ball of extreme heat and extreme power. This heavy metal vapor will meet a very strong air resistance so that the high power of the explosion will dissipate within only meters from the origo, from the central core where the charge was exploding. This means that within a distance of 5 to 10 meters from the explosion, any human body or animal will be torn apart, legs and arms ripped off. The body will have extensive cauterizing burns and injuries which are not survivable, because you will also have very high pressure wave effects on the cavities of the abdomen, the chest, and the brain, and that will cause internal bleeding. But beyond that 10-meter circle, the energy of the explosion will have gone to zero. So these are so-called small-diameter bombs, because the charge can be packed into a very small, almost like a cup of ice, that size. It will have a very targeted effect, so it's developed to make a possibility to kill people in urban zones without having the problem of metal fragments, which will come if you have a grenade or a traditional bomb exploding, because that will cause a swarm of shrapnels which will injure people hundreds of meters away from the explosion. So this dime weapon is extremely powerful. It's very targeted, but when you shoot that into an area as densely populated as Gaza, and bear in mind that Gaza is more densely populated than Singapore and Hong Kong, and the population average age is 17.6 years, and more than half of the population is consisting of children below 18. Of course, when this explosion takes place in so densely populated civilian areas, there will be a large number of killed and injured civilians, children and women. And that's what we saw. That's what we saw. We saw the most horrendous injuries. And I had seen these injuries before, because the first time they applied this weapon technology was probably during the invasion in Lebanon in 2006. I saw the same type of injuries in Gaza during the Israeli Operation Summer Rain in July 2006, and now on a very much greater scale during Operation Cast Lead, we saw the results. And we could do nothing. We could do nothing. We had a 14-year-old boys who came in with both legs cut off at the level of the thigh, dying in our hands. There was no way we could save them. So this weapon technology, it has not been denied, it has not been confirmed by the Israeli army that they use it, but there has been collection of quite extensive evidence of their existence and their use. And they are fired by these unmanned aerial vehicles, the drones, which are also, by the way, produced in U.S. and in Israel. They are remotely controlled from a bunker inside Israel. And the weapon is called fire and forget weapons, meaning that the warlord, the generals, they can shoot and kill without being concerned about their own soldiers being injured. So this is remotely controlled warfare. It was directed against the civilians, the children playing on rooftops. And the results that we saw in Shifa Hospital was absolutely appalling. It was terrible. I have been to many war zones. I have seen landmine injuries. As I mentioned, I was in Beirut in 82. I have never, ever seen such devastating injuries before.
From the drones, Mads, it's sort of like for some of these people operating from a bunker, it's like a video game war. It's not real. It's sort of surreal, like a video game. Very sanitized. You're far away from what's happening. You don't hear anything. You just do this, and I guess you see something on a screen. But it's almost like dots on a computer screen that aren't human. Two other weapons that I wrote about a number of these weapons, and it's been a while. I have to go back and check the ones that I wrote about, but two that I remember were flechettes, which is the opposite of the dime weapon, because that explodes in thousands of metal splinters that carries over, 100 yards, 200 yards, and I think in all directions. So it
yes,
literally
that's right.
can hit many, many people. Whatever it strikes when it explodes, it just disperses and at high speed can hit many, many people. So you've got many fragments in whoever gets hurt, and also the white phosphorus. Maybe you could talk about both.
Well, let me first mention the flechette bombs, because that was also used extensively by the Israelis. We had, among other things, one of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, the Red Cross ambulances, in the northern part of Gaza during one attack. It was taking a direct hit with a flechette grenade, and that is basically a nail bomb. This exploded in the ambulance. One of the paramedics was killed on the spot. The other, Omar, was hit in the abdomen and the chest with a large number of these nails, and he bled to death awake. It was too risky, too difficult to get him in time to Shifa Hospital. Many health workers were killed and injured. The Israeli army do not respect the Red Cross sign, nor the international conventions protecting hospitals and medical personnel in war zones. They don't respect the regulations that they are not allowed to shoot on ambulances, and they are not obeying the rules of protecting civilian populations in conflict zones. When it comes to the phosphorus bombs, they are not illegal. They are, according to international law, they can be used as smoke screens. What is illegal, however, is to shoot these grenades against civilian targets. And that's what they did. They shot them against the Al-Fakura school, which was a UN school, which had been upgraded to be a civilian shelter. The Israeli army had got the coordinates from the UN leadership, John Jing and his people, and it was almost 2,000 civilians in the school when they were taking hits from phosphorus grenades. Two boys were killed, the boy's mother. We had to amputate both her legs, and the school was burnt out. So, you know, there is a long list of war crimes that the Israeli army and the Israeli government perpetrated. And we are documenting this in our book. I think it is also important to remind that the Goldstone Report, the Amnesty International Report, the Arab League Fact-Finding Commission Report, the Israeli Human Rights Organization's reports, Betzalim report, and our book altogether are consistent on the findings, both with regards to the targeting policy of the Israeli forces, the number of civilians killed and injured, the illegal weapons used, and the crimes of the siege as a sort of a weapon of collective punishment. All these things are documented, and I think the time is overdue now to take the Israeli leadership, the government, and the Minister of Defense and the generals to the International Criminal Court in Hague and have a proper trial with documentation, witnesses, so as to have a verdict on the crimes that were perpetrated on the people of Gaza.
It's so long overdue.
As long as this is not done, a large number of the people on the earth will say that there are two standards. One standard from the warlords from the West and for Israel, and one standard for the people of the Arab world and the poor people. This cannot continue. This will be a thorn. This will be a continuous energy of conflict and hatred between the people.
Unfortunately, Mads, as badly as this needs to be done, the International Criminal Court will not do it. And, of course, U.S. leaders and U.S. generals are complicit not only for their alliance with Israel. America supplies Israel with some of its worst terror weapons and billions of dollars every year. And they jointly plan all of these major conflicts. And, again, this has begun many, many months before the actual conflict begins. Heaven knows what they have on the books now. There's always another war on the books. It doesn't mean that it will be launched. No. I mean, America plans wars against multiple enemies. It doesn't carry them all out. But they're on the shelf, as they say, and they're ready to go. And Israel plans for more than it may end up doing. You know, one of my recent articles, I quoted the chief of staff saying they were planning for the next war.
We've had the same news in Norway, and I think it's absolutely good reason to suspect that they want to do that. But I think in the meantime, and we are very concerned with this in Norway in the solidarity movement, we want to highlight and to uphold the pressure on this very wide international front against the continuous siege of Gaza. The siege of Gaza is ongoing as we are speaking. It has not been eased, as Israel was urged to do after the attack on the humanitarian flotilla and the Turkish boat. On the contrary, I'm sitting here in front of me. I have a press release from the 22 most important peace-building, human rights, and humanitarian organizations working in Gaza. And they state on the 30th of November, just before Christmas last year, that there is no signs of improvement in Gaza since this so-called easing of the blockade.
insects, imports of construction material badly needed in Gaza to build up what they bombed, is still only 11% of the 2007 pre-blockade levels. And Israel approves import for only 7% of UN what is needed for the UN rebuilding plan for Gaza. This means, in very simple terms, that nothing is being built up again. No schools, no hospitals, no private homes, no sewer system, water pipelines, mosques. All these houses and constructions that is needed to run a decent society. And the WikiLeaks documentation just recently also showed that the Israeli leadership are titrating the siege so that the 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza shall remain at the brink of a hunger disaster, at the brink of a total collapse, in order to force them into obedience and submission. This cannot go on, and I think we all should engage in the boycott, divestment, and sanction organization at the place that we live. Don't buy Israeli goods. Don't buy Israeli fruits. Try to get your university to divest whatever they have of stocks in Israeli companies. Be active. Take responsibility. As long as you keep silent, you are complicit.
I'm a cultural member of the BDS movement, Mads. I consider that easily the most important initiative to hit Israel where it hurts economically. You can't go to war and defeat Israel. And, of course, Israel is nuclear armed. Its hidden secret, which was a title I used for one of my articles about their nuclear program, multi-decade. But where Israel can be hurt is economically, culturally. Their image, they are worried about those things. And that movement is growing, including in Norway. And in other countries where more people are actively doing something to boycott Israel. I've written several articles of the BDS movement, including a list of Israeli companies to boycott. Don't buy their merchandise. But even more than that, Mads, don't buy from the U.S. companies that have operations in Israel. They are just as guilty. Don't buy from them either. I included them. I don't think I got them all, but I included some very big names in one of my articles. This is very important stuff, and I've had one radio program on it some months back from an Israeli academic who's very involved in the BDS movement, and this is crucial. This is the way to make it hurt. And I wrote about a think tank in Israel that is very, very worried about this. The delegitimizing of Israelis' image, and the fact that this is a growing movement worldwide, and I do believe that Israel shot itself in the foot by Cass Led, and then did it again by the end of May last year, a flotilla attack. I mean, these were things that just aroused world anger, mass protests on city streets around the world. I don't know how a country can help itself by doing things like this. I mean, Israel is very concerned about its image.
I'm sure that they are concerned, and they fear more than anything else. They fear international isolation. And in Norway, we have a very strong boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, and we are now working systematically to have academic boycotts from one or more of our universities, and we hope to succeed in that effort within the next 1 or 2 years. I have to leave now for another commitment, but I'm very happy to have talked to you, my friend, and I'm extremely pleased that the U.S. Audience and the population of the United States are being critical of Israel and are being questioning the U.S. Government policies towards and to support Israel. I've been on 4 different speaking tours in the U.S., and it's always been a pleasure to meet all the concerned people, progressive Jews, people of all beliefs and belongings, and all together working in order to change the U.S. Official policy. The key to a solution of the occupation of Palestine lies in the shelves, on the shelves of the U.S. government. Everybody knows that, and that is why you, the American people, have such an important duty in order to change the policies of your government. I thank you for the chance to talk to you tonight, and I wish you all a very good new year.
It was a great honor for me. I welcome you back on this program anytime. And as anything important happens, please do stay in touch. If it's important and you need to talk about it, I welcome you, and you will be an honored guest on this program anytime.
Thank you so much, and bye-bye.
Thank you, Mads. Again, Mads' book with Eric Fossey, Eyes in Gaza. You look at the cover of that book, and the cover is worth many, many pages, because that really says it. A young child, probably about 4 or 5 years old, just staring out in space, and you know this child has been badly injured and has no idea what happened. Injured, but not old enough to understand what was going on, or why anybody would want to target that child and possibly kill him. But this is what goes on, and it literally goes on every day. It obsesses me. Thankfully, there are many, many, just in the U.S. alone, many, many thousands of Jews alone who are extremely angry about what goes on, who have decided they want to know on a daily basis, if not a daily basis, at least more or less keep up with what's going on. And they absolutely oppose the Israeli agenda and these absolute crimes, war crimes when there's real war going on, crimes of humanity, literally on a daily basis. And the facts are all there to look at and see for yourself. It's not a religious issue. It's not an ethnic issue. It's a human rights issue. It's a civil rights issue. It's a rule of law issue. And again, examine the facts. There's only one conclusion anybody can draw. And I know listeners to this program understand it very, very well, and feel the same way. Otherwise, they wouldn't spend time listening to this program. This topic will come back again and again and again. It was wonderful having Mads on. We will be back again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and always on the weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And wonderful guests. I try to get wonderful people to come on and talk about some of the most important topics. And I just wish we had more time, because these things are so vital. We are living through some terrible times, and the root of these problems lies in Washington, D.C. There is no question, whether we're talking about occupied Palestine, whether we're talking about all other parts of the Middle East, whether we're talking about growing repression in America. America literally, and I've said this, literally is on a fast track toward tyranny and ruin. We have become a police state. But it gets tighter and tighter and tighter. I put out a new article today on what's called the SHIELD Act, targeting First Amendment freedoms, going after whistleblowers like WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. It's on my blog site, Steve Lendman Blog. Again, plain facts in black and white. Anybody can read them and see what's happening. This is the Obama administration that promised change. Remember that? Remember that? He didn't tell us what kind of change he had in mind. Well, it really wasn't. The only change were the names of the faces. The policy has been the same. Join us again next time.